Are we ready to start?
Anytime.
Okay, on the count of one. Three, two, one.
Hi, we're here interviewing former Justice Robert Irwin for the oral history project that the Alaska court system is doing. I had the pleasure of working with Bob for 5 years, and so I'm delighted to see him again. Let's start with some of your personal background, Bob. Could you tell me where were you born?
I was born down in Seward. My father was the manager for Chevron for most of Alaska from 1921 until 1960. And so I have two brothers. We were all born in Seward and went through Seward High School to graduation, and then from then on went off. I went to the University of Colorado, got a degree in business, and then went to the law school at the University of Washington when I graduated in 1959.
And what did your brothers do?
Well, my one brother was a senior engineer and executive at Boeing for 40 years, who retired about 6 or 7 years ago, after trying to retire for 10 years. And then my brother Bill is a lawyer, and he's still practicing here in Anchorage. And so, interestingly enough, he has one daughter who's an attorney, and I have a son and a daughter who are attorneys, and one daughter who's a paralegal for a rather large firm in Portland.
And did you have your entire childhood in Kenai, or did you go to other communities?
No, I grew up in Seward, and actually lived there the whole time in
Seward.
In those days, Seward was an interesting part of Alaska. Everything came to Alaska by boat. And so you flew and you took the boat. We got 2 passenger boats a week in Seward. And then you got on the train the next day and came to Anchorage or Fairbanks, which you're going. And then everything went out the same way. And if you wanted to go to the westward, you went by boat. And so a boat ran out of Seward to Kodiak and out to the westward and back. So I graduated from high school. When I started college, you're still going back and forth by boat until, oh gosh, I would say 53, 54, something like that. So Seward was a fairly viable community with a rather large people from all over Alaska going and coming through there.
So you remember any significant activities or significant events that took place during your childhood?
The Second World War, of course. Seward was considered the most strategic part of the North Pacific Second World War, and of course, when the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor and so forth, we had about 15,000 troops in Seward. They had a submarine net at the mouth of the thing. We had coast artillery. We had all of these pillboxes and so forth all around, and a 10-stand barbed wire fence all around the waterfront. And since the Standard Oil, which my father was manager of, had this huge plant, it was inside the fence, and so we had to have a place where he could get back and forth. And then when they brought some prisoners in from Attu and Kiska, they were stationed right across the street from us in a barbed wire enclosure. So you remember the Japanese, that aspect of it. It was still, the end of the Second World War. It was the main lend-lease port for shipping to Vladivostok. So we would have 40 or 50 Russian ships in, and then every vacant lot in Seward would be filled with war material. And so you would be caught even in the schoolyard at times. So you'd have tanks and guns and all of that. And the port ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I always remember it because most of the Russian ships were staffed by women. And so the whole crew would be women, and they would take a whole load of tanks or a whole load of guns. It's a constant process. And we only had 8 or 9 berths, so it was constant. And then the warships would come in to be filled with fuel. So you might have a cruiser at the Standard Oil dock, or you might have this. And it was really a kind of, the town was just sort of
alive
for the whole time. And then after the war, it stopped. Suddenly it stops. And then that started. So it was kind of fascinating how it was a very viable, vibrant place right up until the time of the earthquake, when the waterfront disappeared. It's just like you took a knife, went all the way around, it all fell into the bay. You can't tell by looking, but the railroad yards and all of the docks, the marineways and everything, just collapsed into the bay. And so when they sent divers down, there was just, it was figured that it was covered by at least a couple hundred feet of rock. And so where the Standard Oil dock was, it had about 30 feet of water, there was now 110 feet. And where the dock, or where my father's office was, there's now 90 feet of water. So you just, you know, that, and they did all the way. And so now it just looks like, you know, a very nice community, but all of that disappeared in 5 minutes.
And was that because of the shaking of the earthquake or a tsunami?
Yeah, well, what happened was, it was sort of like being in a bathtub. And apparently they had 8 or 10 of these huge waves covered parts of the town, but they would go way up on the mountainsides and back. So what happened was, and the strange part about it, when you listen to the history, they can't agree whether there was 9 tsunamis or 11. Now, when you hear all the history and you talk to all the people, there were either 9 or 11. And it took out 2 or 3 parts of the town, one on the lower part and then one down where there were 2 lagoons and there's only one now. It took all of that and then took the entire waterfront. And then where the plant was, which had huge tanks, 100,000 barrel tanks, there were about, oh, I think there were 14 in the tank yard. Not one of them. They found one of them at the end of the runway 3 miles away. The rest of them they found no trace of. And the size of the plant, they had 2 warehouses. One was 600 feet by 400 feet, and the other one was 600 feet by 150 feet, and there's no trace of it.
Was there any significant loss of life in Seward?
Well, 9 or 10 is all. I mean, it's an amazing small amount of life. Property damage, I know Standard Oil alone was like $75 or $100 million. I mean, it was a huge plant that they covered all of Alaska with, and they would ship from there, and we had, in those days, tanker 3 to 5 a week, so directly from San Francisco. So it was a very interesting, you know, going from one to another. And then when they rebuilt, of course, for years, Lloyd's of London would not insure anything in Cook Inlet after about the either September 20th or October 1. And so the ships wouldn't come into anchorage, or when they discovered that they would cover that, so they started coming. They built a plant in Anchorage, which was a lot closer. You didn't have to ship it from Seward to Anchorage on the railroad. So that was, entire thing changed 100%.
Yeah, and the whole feeling of the community had to change.
Yeah, and everybody didn't have to come to Seward to come to Anchorage. You built an airport here, and came to Anchorage and flew out. That is, this is a very, the whole view of Alaska and what happened changed just almost when the International Airport opened. I think, let's see, my second year of college, I think we flew out of International Airport, so that would got to be 54 or 55.
And where did you, again, did you say you went to college?
I went to the University of Colorado as an undergraduate, and from there in Boulder. And then I came back and went to law school at the University of Washington.
And what did you major in college?
Well, it was finance and accounting. And I got a Bachelor of Science in Finance and Accounting. It's one of the strange things, you have to get a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Guesswork. And then to law school. And I was going to be a bank accountant, and I discovered that, no, I didn't want to do that.
My son also went to Boulder. I've got to visit him. It's a beautiful community.
Wonderful place.
Yes. What inspired you to pursue a career in law?
Well, I always wanted to work for Chevron. My father worked 45 years, and I had this idea I could get a law degree and I'd go to work in the legal department for Chevron. And when I graduated, you imagine my amazement when I discovered that Chevron is the only Fortune 500 company that doesn't have a legal department, that it has, in fact, Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro, a very large firm in San Francisco, is their legal department, and they have a vice president and so forth, and they've never had a legal department, and in all their mergers, they disbanded all the legal departments of the companies they have, and they still don't have a legal department. So that was first I went awry, and then of course I came up and statehood, it just was in the offing. So I thought I was going to be inducted in the military, and that didn't come off. And so I called Juno, and the Attorney General was just leaving, John Rader, to hire lawyers for the Attorney General's office, the statehood company. And he hired me on the spot, and so I arrived in Juneau in October, late September, early October of 59.
So you attended law school 57, 58, 59?
Yeah, I graduated in June, took the bar exam in Washington, and came up here really thinking I was going to go into the military.
Tell me a little about your law school experience. How'd you like it?
Well, I don't think anybody likes law school. I, you know, those people that liked it, I thought, need to be psychiatrically examined. But I mean, it took all your time and all your effort to the exclusion of everything else. I like to do a lot of things. I discovered that if you work 24 hours a day, you could probably get in the top 20% in your class. That's if you work 24 hours a day, and then it goes down to 18, 16, 14, you know. And I discovered that having to work that hard to accomplish something, you enjoyed law school, but the grade, the way the structure was, it was really a difficult time to, you know, and when you graduated, you really feel like you accomplished something, because the idea was there, and I still remember the beginning speech. The guy says, look to the right of you, now look to the left of you, and you know, one of those two people will be pumping gas next year, you know, and their job was that they do, in those days, 180 people, and they only said at least 50% of you will be gone, and we will make sure that happens. And so we graduated, I think, like 67 out of 180.
I got the same speech, but I think more got through. But I think that's the speech that gave the scary.
That's right. It is scary, as a matter of fact. I mean, it's a very interesting way to approach it.
Did you have a favorite area when you were in law school, any class that was a favorite? Constitutional law was my favorite class.
No, I just sort of wandered around through some of it, not really certain, you know, in law school when you get the diverse subjects. And, some of them stuck with me, and I got reasonable grades in, and some of them, I always like to tell people later on, there were two things that I didn't do well in. One was legal writing, and I got 61 in legal writing, and 60 was the lowest grade you can get, and each is 1 hour for 3 semesters. And then I got a D in criminal law, which was, I get a 64. Now later on, I was district attorney, and then I was an appellate judge, and I thought, man, that's a bad predictor of what's about to happen.
So you basically describe your law school experience as 4 years of, the 3 years of constant work and no fun.
That's right, that's basically what it was.
Then you came back up to Little Alaska, and you contacted John Rader before you left?
No, when I came back, my brother was a young teacher down in Seward, and he decided with statehood that for the first state legislature that there was nobody around, so he was going to run for the legislature. So he was about 25, and he put his name in, and with help of a longtime Seward character, Saul Urey, got elected to the first state legislature. So he was down the first time, and they were just getting grounded and setting together the government and so forth. And so when I graduated from law school, I said, what's going on? And he said, well, come on up. And we lived together down at Seward. And so then he said, why don't you call John Rader? They're going to hire. We've appropriated some money. He needs 5 or 6 or 7 people. And he's going to make a swing through the states. And he's going to leave fairly soon. So when I discovered, I ended up 4F. So I was kind of the music story, the true story, really. I'm out on the base. I thought we'd gone through everything. My name's on the list. I'm going to fly down to Fort Ord, California to take basic training. And so as they're going along, they check, 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 and I say, Irwin. And he said, Irwin, what are you doing here? You're 4F. And I took my gear, and I walked across the street, and there was a Times newspaper truck delivering things, and there's a kid in there I knew, and I got in the back and I said, take me down to the westward. So then I went back to Seward for 2-3 weeks, called John Rader, he said, come on, you have a job, you're hired. And so I got on the plane and flew to Juneau. And so it was an interesting time because they were just putting the office together, and of course they were hiring both a head of the civil division, which turned out to be Jay Rabinowitz, and hiring the head of the criminal division, which is George Hayes. And so I was immediately assigned to something like the Irwin, you get a background accounting, you get the Department of Revenue, the Pioneer Home, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and somebody else, you know, which is fine. I say, what's that? And he said, and then you'll have to help us draft legislation to keep prisoners in jail and all of that sort of thing. So we're off and running right from the other. And then John Rader went out and he made a swing, and he hired Herb Sowell, John Havelock, he hired Joe Rudd for here, he hired Ted Pease, he hired, there were a couple more, and I mean,
pretty good
all at one town, yeah, he had, and they all showed up and they had great talent. So that was one of those things as we started off, and I ultimately started to work for directly under Rabinowitz, who was a very brilliant man and a great teacher. So we then put everything together we could, and then immediately what happened is we're right in the middle of getting things together, starting to try and figure out how to prosecute and all of that, when the Ninth Circuit came down with a case saying we no longer have legal authority to pass upon criminal cases in Alaska, so you're going to have to form your own prosecution system and your own court system. So then there was a mad scramble. First we had to have judges, then we had to have prosecuting attorneys and so forth. And so the first process they went through was picking the first number of judges. And I was in Juneau when they were all sworn in, and went off to New Jersey for a 2 or 3 week thing. So I got to meet all of them. And I had a start. John Diamond was a long time personal friend. And so his father and my father had been close friends. And so John took me under his wing, he's a delightful man, and helped me out in Juneau, which was a really thing. And then, so one thing led to another, and I met Jim Vonderheit, who was going to be the, had been in Rome, and who had been the first Superior Court judge in Juneau. And of course, he was talking to me about being in Nome and about there was no one there, no attorneys, there's nothing, and that they needed a district attorney and they needed a lot of things. And I never paid a lot of attention to this. And so finally, it was Virgil Bohaska was working in the Attorney General's office from territorial days, and he finally decided he was going to go off to Nome to be the private attorney. And so one thing led to another, and I was kind of interested, just off at my father had always said, well, you take these out of the way jobs and they'll bring you back to a better job. They won't forget you because they were in a bind in the beginning. And so one thing led to another, and finally John Rader said, well, you go to Nome as district attorney. Now, you got to remember, I had just come out of law school. I had just been 6 months, and I had never seen a trial. I've seen a criminal trial, and you're going to be known to be district attorney in an area the size of California. So, you know, the whole thought is, well, who's going to be the judge? And so I had met Hugh Gilbert, who is a very delightful, personable guy from Fairbanks, and his wife, who was a human dynamo when it came to doing anything. And I thought, well, that's even, I know Virgil, so he was going to have to try part of the cases. So I thought, I'm single, what difference does it make? So I'll go to Nome and be district attorney. And so they stopped me off in Fairbanks so I could see a trial or two, so what was going on. And we go to Nome, and as we started, it was kind of fascinating because we're the first court to get ready to try a case. And Hugh Gilbert is called a grand jury, and they have 5 or 6 indictments, people who'd really been in jail about a year from the U.S. Marshal Service and waiting trial. So the grand jury turned down indictments and he set trials. Well, I arrived in March and there are 5 trials set in a row, including a murder, first degree murder case, and a sexual assault case, and burglary and a forgery case of all things and so forth. And these are cases, you know, you wonder where what's going to happen. So we start and he's going to pick a jury, and I say to George Hayes, how am I going to try a murder case? I don't even know where the body is. And it was one of these weird cases where a guy was killed at the mouth of the Yukon. They took the body out. They said he was shot in the head. They put him on a platform at the Delta, and there was the body. No medical person had ever looked at it and so forth. So George says to me over the phone, I'll be up to help you, but where's the body? So I asked around, we find the body's there. Can you bring it to Nome for an autopsy? And so I got to Alaska Airlines, you know, I said to the state police trooper, this is your baby. They go out there, this thing is still above ground on four posts, because they put it, they take what's there, put it in a body bag, and they ship it to Nome. Now, luckily enough, there was a bullet inside its head, so we could tell he was killed. And we ultimately had a trial where the guy was convicted. But I mean, it was, you know, it's sort of like, how do you do this? You know, who's going to do this? And of course, I then started out, and I was prosecuted the first case ever tried in the new state court system. This case called State versus Jimmy Moses.
Instead of Hugh Gilbert.
Now, that was the first case for Hugh Gilbert, the first defense for Virgil Prochazka, the first prosecution by me, but the defendant was an old hand. He'd been convicted four times before, and so he was acquitted. He had more ability than the rest of us, so we were off and running. So that the first case tried in the court system was State versus Jimmy Moses. So I lost the first case, and Virgil won the first case. So we went on, and then we tried the cases, and George Hayes did give up to try Matthew Tyson, who was a first-degree murder case, and I think everybody in the courtroom was pulling for Matthew to be acquitted. It was a terrible case in which his father had kept him attached, or really by chain, under the house, and fed him with the dogs, and beat him with a dog chain, and finally, and grandmother let him loose and give him a gun, and he went in there and shot the guy who beat up all of them for years. I mean, it was terrible testimony. And this little Matthew Tyson was, he looked like a Renaissance angel. He had both a Belgian breast, which is a deformity, which comes to a point, and a hunchback. So he was the same size sitting down or standing up. And he was only about, if he was 4 foot tall, I'd be surprised. And so ultimately one thing led to another, and he was convicted of second degree murder. And in those days, the statute required a mandatory 15 years minimum sentence. So we sentenced him reluctantly. You had to, there's nothing you could do, to 15 years to serve. And I don't think anybody felt guilty about it. And you know, about 6 months later, I got this card from his uncle telling this wonderful thing being done for this kid, as he was a model prisoner in the federal prison system, that they made him a jeweler. He traveled from place to place about vocational training and things. He was wonderful. Everybody loved him. And from then on, for the next 5 years, I got cards from this kid, Matthew Tyson, saying this is the best thing that ever happened to him. And I suppose, in retrospect, being chained to the eaves of a tent out on the Yukon Delta was a hell of a lot different than being lionized in the federal prison system. It did taught me something. You just simply have to keep this in focus as to what you were doing. But we tried a bunch of cases there in Nome, five or six in a row, and you started that. And then when we ran out of cases, then I was transferred or asked to go to Fairbanks because they were trying to get their system up and operating. And the Fairbanks system, what had happened was the presiding judge, Everett Hepp, who was just ready to get started, crashed his plane and killed a prominent businessman there, and he was in the hospital. So the whole thing was in turmoil. So they had to bring the judge up from Ketchikan, Judge Waltz, and Judge Vonderheit from Fairbanks to try and, I mean from Juneau, to get this thing going. And so then I was handed over to the district court, which meant that for 3 months I never left the court. We tried at least one case, and mostly two, every single day. I mean, I just, guy come in and hand me a file and we kept going. But the first case was from territorial days, they had a couple hundred what we called the United States Commissioner Court Appeals. And what they were, if you were convicted in the United States Commissioner Court and Territorial Court, you got a trial de novo if you appealed. So of course everybody who lost appealed. And there were years, I mean some of them were 5, 6, 7 years older, so they handed me 250 or 280 cases and say, pick the best two and let's get off to a good start. Well, I picked best two. And so I had, the first one was a directed verdict. I think it was to Rabinowitz, who by that time was a Superior Court judge. And we simply didn't have enough proof, and it was the best case. And so I had the distinction of losing the first case in the Fairbanks district, too. So it's against Cliff Fairchild, who owned a hotel at Fort Yukon. And the next case was a bootlegging case in which the victims had drank all the liquor. And so we lost that case, too, because we wouldn't prove that they were sold alcohol because they hadn't preserved the bottles. And after that, we dismissed 270 Commissioner Court Appeals going back 6 or 7 years because we had neither witnesses or proof. And that, so that we got the calendar off to a good start. But I mean, it was an interesting. So I was in Fairbanks, and I stayed in the famous Lane Hotel, or the fire, I'll think of it in a minute. The hotel had burned later on. I stayed there for 5 months, and then it burned about 2 months later to the ground. It would have lost a life, as a matter of fact, the Nordale Hotel. And then I bounced back and forth. I would go back to Nome and try 2 or 3 cases, and then I would go there. Or I'd come to Anchorage and help out in the Anchorage office. When by this time, George Hayes is back, and he's being district attorney here. So I would come down to help him, and ultimately George then got appointed attorney general. So I replaced Bill Taylor in Fairbanks, so I was sort of first in Nome, second in Fairbanks, and I think I was about fourth district attorney here, because Warren Culver had been the first district attorney. And then after that, he'd taken over Jim Merbs. No, George had been district attorney, and then Jim Merbs was, and I replaced Merbs as to that aspect of it. And I stayed on. I was district attorney here then through the earthquake. And at that time, I was, I'd been almost 6 years, I think. And when I got here, and I think it's no secret, the office was in some serious disarray, and my job was simply to put it back together again, make sure it was an effective organization. I had a wonderful staff of people, and they really did a great job. And so in those days, the district attorney did the civil end of it as well as the criminal. So every attorney did double duty. You were assigned a state agency. You know, we had all of the condemnation, we had all of the Division of Lands and the Department of Natural Resources, we had Air Force, we had everything. And it was really the reason why you left, it was a 16-hour day job, 7 days a week. And you know, you got a vacation when you're too tired to sleep. That's basically what it boiled down to. And the way you get a hold of the district attorney's office is I presented all the cases to the grand jury myself, every single one of them. So the grand jury met once a month, so every single case, and then I assigned the case to a DA whose talents fit that case. And we went from having about a 20 or 30% success rate to having a 99% rate, which you should have, it's practical matter. Now the earthquake, of course, threw us a curveball. I was ready to go into private practice then when the earthquake hit, and I was waiting for Jim Wanamaker, who's going to be my successor, who was in the National Guard, to come in when the earthquake hit. So he's immediately nationalized for a couple of weeks, so I have to stay around and try and clean up and be of what help you can during the earthquake. And there's not a lot a lawyer could do during the earthquake, let me put it that way. I think my most productive one, my wife and I made 200 or 300 cheese sandwiches a day over at the police station for people to eat, and I did going with the magistrate, Jim St. Amour, and we furloughed all the people in the jail who were not thieves or murderers. Now, the jail, of course, had no heat, water, anything, electricity, and, you know, they had been bounded around in the bars. Most of them were banged up, several of them injured, but what you told them was, and we had National Guard troops stationed all over the downtown, is, look, if somebody says halt, throw yourself in the ground, throw your hands up and say, I surrender, because they're going to shoot you if you behave. And we didn't have any looting, none at all. And so it was an interesting thing. I think over the jail there were 70 or 80 people, and we let out about 45. We looked through it, and we never had one of those return for any problem with that. But the problem during the earthquake was the people reacted 90% of them incredibly well, and then there was the 10% who couldn't seem to, they didn't know what the hell had happened. And so they did whatever they thought, and some of them were just almost crazed in their approach to it. So we had trouble shutting down some bars, and we went a little extra legal. We sent the state troopers in with a chainsaw. And those people that wouldn't close down voluntarily, we told them to cut the bar out, throw it in the street. And it has made a lot of difference. Yes, we stopped a lot of just plain difficult times. And somebody had to say yes, whether or not we could unscramble it later on. It's like we had railroad bridges that cars could drive over if you put down planking. And somebody had to say, well, it's government property. Can we do this? Somebody had to say yes to it. And so my job was to say yes. And so I said yes to a lot of things that later on they said, well, you can't do that. Well, it was a practical thing. And what had happened is the citizens group that formed to sort of try and bring things back to order was full of extremely practical people. And so what we did, and with 90% of the populace really outdoing themselves to help, we really accomplished miracles in, say, a week's time. You know, we reestablished electricity everywhere, and what happened, the earthquake had knocked most of our gas turbines literally off their cement foundations and tore up a couple of, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 feet of gas line. So in a week's time, they re-poured, redid that, put them back on, and they were back online, like something that's theoretically impossible in a week's time. And we borrowed equipment from every equipment yard or cellar in town. Some of them we couldn't get permission, but we just took it because it had to be done. And with that attitude, it really worked out very well. With the people that were willing to say yes and help, there were only a few that were willing to say no. Most everybody did. So I got a send-off then, but I have an interest. A story that I really love. After I took on vacation, I went on down to California, and we were at Lake Tahoe, and somebody found out that I'd been up here during the earthquake, and so they wanted to, so they gave me a table right next to the stage at one of the big casinos and so forth, and so gave us dinner and all of that. And so the first act is an elephant standing on its head right on the edge of the stage over our table. And all I could think of during the whole time is, here I survived the Alaska earthquake to be killed by an elephant falling on me. So yeah, I came back up here, that I went to work then as for a private law firm.
Well, let me hold you up here for one second. You got married, I guess, when you moved to Anchorage.
Yeah, I got married actually in Nome, '61, and then we were married, and our first child came after the earthquake, actually, in Anchorage. So we were married three or four years. I got married in '61 in Nome. And so then we came in, our first child, Janet, came in November of '64. And so then, up until then, and then we had four more children. And then, as Mike happened, was born after I was sworn in as a justice on the Supreme Court.
And was your home damaged during the earthquake?
No, we were packed to move. Everything we had except a huge sunburst clock was packed. And so that was in little pieces, and everything else was fine. I mean, it was one of those weird things.
One of those lucky,
yeah, lucky things that happened.
I was going to ask you if you had any mentors in your early years, but it seems like you were the mentor.
Well, you had, you know, Alaska was a funny place. And you got to remember, 1959, I went to the first bar convention in Alaska down in Ketchikan, and I think it was 1960, might have been 61. But the total number of lawyers was 175. That included public lawyers and everybody. So, you know, there were enough jobs for everybody. It was a question of, you want a job, take a job. And so it was for people who wanted to come, and those that did come, some of them were incredibly talented people who made great careers for themselves. But there were more jobs than there were people. So you could do what you wanted to do, really. And so that's the way it always was, like, you know, as you started out, and it wasn't until much later when we had more lawyers and we had jobs. So I always felt it was lucky, it was the right time, right place, and it's always better to be lucky than good, I'll tell you that. It's the one of those things.
A hero center.
Yeah, you know.
No, I remember even when I came in 73, yeah, that I knew most of the lawyers by their names.
Oh, yeah.
Because there were still few enough of them even in 73 that you knew a lot of the members of the bar.
Well, there's nobody over in Nome until Virgil came. When he got there actually a couple of months before I did. And then ultimately Neil Canelli came over at that time, and that was about a year later. In Fairbanks, there weren't more than 13, 14 lawyers.
Yeah.
I mean, you were all personally acquainted with everybody. And when I came to Anchorage, it seemed to me that there were about 70 lawyers here total. So you knew all of the people that were actively in court. There, of course, we were talking about federal lawyers, we're talking about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a different sort of thing. You know, the huge majority of what went on is you knew, saw the people almost every day, and you talked to them, and so there were only a few disputes that couldn't be settled amiably. And actually, as I find out later in my practice, a lot more economically than we do it now.
Well, you went out from the DA's office after the earthquake and you formed your practice. Did you go out alone, or did you?
No, I went in with, at that time, the biggest law firm in the state was Hughes, Thorsness and Lowe. And there were five, and I was going to be number six. And I did. During the time I'd been in the DA's office, I'd written a lot of appeals, criminal appeals, 20 or 25 of them. And when I went over to Hughes, Thorsness and Lowe, the civil thing, of course, they loaded all those on me, and I started off. And I'd been in the DA's, and I tried a lot of cases. Everybody had to have their own share. You divided up the number of cases to be tried by the number of attorneys, and everybody had their own set. So I had more of my set of trials. And so I went over there, and you sort of went through what was really the start of the oil development. I was lucky enough to be involved in the Middle Ground Shoal in Cook Inlet and the discovery royalties and all of that. And so they were really large cases. And Starter Prudhoe Bay, both competitive and non-competitive leasing and all of that. So every law firm in town had what later turned out to be rather large clients, but you know, you were in areas totally unknown. You know, we didn't have much offshore oil drilling law, we didn't have this, we were in the start of native, all kinds of native problems. We hadn't had the native land claim settlement yet. That was all a huge issue at that time. And so there were incredible legal problems. And so you really, you know, I can't ever remember not being incredibly busy with the diversity of problems, which are hard to explain to somebody who just goes in to a law firm and you get one thing and that's all you do.
Are there any one or two significant cases in that
area? Well, Middle Ground Shoal was a horrendous case in which what happened is when they drilled the first well, it blew out and it created a shoal off a couple of hundred yards from the platform, in which, I mean, a literally shoal 3 or 4 feet high was the gas blowing back into the inlet. Well, then what happened was is that Pan American Petroleum, who was a player in those days, applied for discovery royalty to the state of Alaska. And in those days, you're actually on your lease, you paid 12.5%, but the discovery royalty was 7.5%, so you only had to pay 5%. And the size of the field, from looks like they were going to hit, they were talking millions, $25, $30, $40 million. And so what happened is then Shell Oil Company came in on the same, they had adjoining leases, and put a well down, but no blowout. So they actually had control. So the question was, is the discovery one that actually shows it's there, or is if it's controlled? Now, then they heard that Pan American drilled two more wells on site, and so you're in fighting over a rather unique thing. And under federal law, you have to control, not just see. Under gold mining, you find this, that's enough, but this is actually getting. So through a rather complicated process, we ended up, and actually the Supreme Court then affirmed a case, which one of the appeal I handled, where my client got the royalty, and it was a very, very important case, and At that time, I think it was worth $25, $30 million, so we're talking about the 60s.
A lot of money.
A lot of money at that time. It's, you know, that was a significant case, it's a practical matter. I still remember it took us a couple of years to resolve it. Very hard fought with really good counsel on the inside, Joe Rudd, who is a petroleum engineer and lawyer, just a first-rate natural resource lawyer, and Gene Wiles, who represented Chevron for years and come out of the solicitor's office. They really knew what they were doing. So it was really kind of a wrestling match for years, 2-3 years. And then I had a whole bunch of other cases. You know, I think as I've done 20 in the DA's office, I think I did another 30 or 40. And then it turned out when Justice Nesbitt was in a plane crash, then that seat was going to become vacant. And it became as they hoped he would recover. And basically, he physically, to a point, recovered, but he felt he couldn't, he had headaches and other things, so he retired, and that was in 1970. So at that time, I had decided that, well, I would put my name in, see what happened. And again, luck was with me, both by the people I was against, the political climate that takes place, all of the other things that happened would actually made a prophet out of Justice Traynor of California, who said, judges are political accidents. And that's true. You can never again, even at this date, recreate the competition, the political climate, and your friends and enemies. I mean, they all coalesce to you get appointed. Now, I was appointed by Governor Miller, a Republican. I've been a lifelong Democrat. When you count on your fingers how many judges have been appointed across party lines, you will find that short of Louisiana, where Huey Long appointed his son and his cousins, that doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen.
It just doesn't happen. I did not think I would be appointed. I had done a lot of appellate work by that time, 40 or 50. I probably as much as anybody in Alaska, and so I was familiar with the process. It just didn't seem like, you know, what was going to happen. And so I was somewhat surprised when I was appointed, because I didn't expect it. And of course, that was started another career at this point.
Right. I really want you to describe your early years on the bench, because it was just so evolving.
Yeah, everything we had started out, and of course, the first 10 years, I'd say, under Nesbitt's. Now, I took Nesbitt's seat, and interestingly enough, since then, only one other justice has had that same seat. That's Matthews. So Matthews served 30 years, almost 30. I served 7, and Nesbitt had served the 10 before that. So all the rest of them have sort of turned over several times, but this one seat has been fairly constant in people. But what happened was, is during the Nesbitt years, there were 3 members of the court, and it was a very conservative, very, sort of tight court, let's put it that way. It shouldn't have been, but it was, and maybe given the startup of the state, the makeup of the state, the fact that things were not going very well economically, a lot of things made for a system which simply was very difficult to penetrate from a standpoint if you were an outsider or the public or anyone else. You really didn't know what. And then we got into this huge fight between the bar and the bench, which was really more a personality fight, in my opinion, left over from territorial days. People who had personal animosity toward each other lined up on different sides, and some, it just carried over. And Justice Nesbitt, whatever anybody says about him, was a very difficult, quiet man, very difficult man to discuss anything with. And I learned this later, because when I was in private practice, I represented him. So, I mean, he was a very difficult client, very difficult man to have a discussion on all sides of issues with. I mean, he just was very closed. It's kind of interesting person. Very hard man to move, but at that time, he needed to be a hard man. He was trying to build courthouses. He was trying to get space. He was trying to get a lot of things. So, he was the paperclip counter, so to speak. And then when they increased the size of the court, then in the late 60s, by 2 people, then the appointed 2 people who were the political opposites, Nesbitt, which was, and of course, they were, their philosophies were so totally different that they didn't mesh at all. So there was constant jockeying for position almost of what the hell was going on. And it really led to, everybody was sort of, it's like watching a tennis match as to who's going to score the last point. And odd things happened. I mean, in retrospect, you know, it's really predictable. But what happened was the court had to evolve. Now we start tremendous economic activity, a bigger caseload, more people come in, increasing in the size of the court. You had to open up to make things happen, and it had to be on a professional basis. You just couldn't run this out of your pocket. And that's the way it was run. It was, everything was yes approval by the Chief Justice or no approval by the Chief Justice. And you can't, there was too much to do. And so what happened when I was appointed in 1970 then, I sort of joined a group who was very progressive in their view of it. Not, you know, even though we were different political philosophies, I would have to say there was no conservative in any way. We wanted the best way, and so that's what we were attempting to do, both legally and otherwise. Now, whether or not we were effective administratively, I can't answer that until we hired Art, but because the first couple of years were totally chaotic because administration sort of took a back seat. And George Bonney, who was, had one great thing, he showered sparks like it's like a sparkler. Whether or not you're going to follow up on that with something else, but it was exciting to listen to because he had sparks. He was a very intelligent man. And so the things that he thought, if he had time to sort them out, he had some really good ideas. And they looked like, you know, they would take off. And he realized we needed professional help and that's when I was appointed to head of the search committee, where Art was, we needed a professional court administrator. And I had to make some of the phone calls and help that and direct the interviews and that type of thing, which I did. I recommended very highly that Art be hired because of his background, for two reasons. I didn't think that he would knuckle under to we had an integrated court system, and up to that point, it had been so run by individual judges, both to a great detriment, let's put it that way. And but we needed, you know, unified systems to do everything, from hauling jurors to making sure we had recording offices, to getting magistrates who worked in that system, to really put rules together. The whole works that you have to run a professional court, not, you know, just, you know, go down there and you're going to have the old days, a Ptolemaic, you know, King Solomon will be here and he would stand in the courtyard and present you. We were doing a lot of that, and that was pretty hard to do. So what happened then, unfortunately, George Bonney was in an accident and died. And most people don't remember, George was only 43 years old. And so when you talk about, everybody thought he'd be Chief Justice on the court for years.
Well, you know, on that point, wasn't there a constitutional amendment that
we did? Because of the fight over the disparity of beliefs or opinions between the various judges, we normally had a Chief Justice who was appointed for the full time use on the court. And the bar, because of its differences with him, and actually with the active participation of two of the justices on the court, they then passed a constitutional amendment saying that the court would elect a Chief Justice every 3 years, and no one could succeed themselves, but they could have additional terms. And so what happened then, George Bonney then is elected Chief Justice, but of course, nobody, that's not a problem because there wasn't really anybody to oppose him when Nesbitt went off. And of course, Nesbitt was, he kept tight control because he handpicked the person to be administrative director. And so the two of them really kept the court quite tightly wrapped up. And the difference with having a Chief Justice that rotated, you would have administrative director with the power, which you basically needed, and it would not be focused solely on the Chief Justice. And that's, you know, what it turned out to be. As they rotated, then you still had an administrative director who made sure that the policies were uniformly applied. And that makes a tremendous difference, where particularly the way Alaska is. It's, having lived in both Juneau, Nome, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, there are incredible differences in both the personalities of the people and the economics and the way things are. And you just, trying to keep it uniform takes some real effort.
Well, on my part, you know, I made sure that you people would have to sit down with me once a week and go over an administrative agenda, because any one of you could be Chief Justice at any time, and you had to be involved in these major decisions. So it wasn't just one or two people, the whole court was involved. And of course,
prior to that time, you wouldn't. The other two justices had no idea what was going on, you know, and they would be accosted literally on the street by people saying, how come you're doing X? And they didn't have any idea what the policy was. So it was a tremendous effort.
And what were some of the major cases that came before the court when you were on it?
We had a number of them. We had a number, I can remember, the North Slope Borough, as to whether or not it could be a local government unit in what is, it's roughly the size of Colorado. So we had, you know, could we do that? And that was the thing. We had a number of huge construction cases, one over at Nome called Nordine versus the City of Nome, where they were trying to put sewer and water in Nome, and he just couldn't figure out what was going on. But we had, and Justice Rabinowitz wrote a number of constitutional law opinions which talked about the personal rights of people and established the rule that the Alaska constitutional provision was greater in scope than the federal constitution, and therefore the personal rights and the right of privacy, which ultimately became an amendment to the Alaska Constitution. These things were individually discussed at great length. And I really do, Rabinowitz was a very brilliant constitutional scholar, and he wrote some really outstanding opinions as to what was going on. Then we had a number of opinions on the Bigger versus Carr, one man, one vote, which were really important because we established two principles. One, that the military should be counted for the purposes of determining who got to vote. And that, that one man, one vote was the principle, was as far as we could take it in Alaska, but there are geographical barriers up here that you can't lump. You lump people together who have nothing in common. So we had to try and sort out what socioeconomic differences are. And some of the election districts were just huge.
Redistricting cases, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had spent all kinds of time. And one time, when the court asked for the redistricting board whether they could do, if they could do it again, they said no. So we had to appoint masters to, and the interesting part about the whole thing, in 3 weeks they came up with absolutely brilliant plan where there's only minuscule variations, and we have the next election on it. So the next time they said to us, you know, we can't do this, we just simply said to them, look, we can find people who will, you have the choice of doing it. And we really did get that off. We tried to make that a nonpartisan thing. But again, there were immense problems because nobody knew what these very broad words meant. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you couldn't tie southeastern Alaska to interior Alaska. You couldn't put together people of Eskimo heritage with people of Indian heritage. And, you know, we had all, they had nothing in common.
I know people on the outside just think of Alaska Natives, but the Indians didn't like the Eskimos.
And the Aleuts were different. And southeastern Alaska has an entirely different view of what Alaska is, and the Eskimos can't even visualize what's going on in Juneau. So it was a fascinating tour de force of trying to, one, delineate the rights, and of course, then we'd had Native Land Claim Settlement, and now we're trying to put together what the Native Regional Corporations were, what the Village Corporations were, who the people were, how we were going to govern them under a system, what's going to be like, we're talking about reservations, or we're and so all of this is, and then we have oil, and so then the economics of oil are really quite remarkable as their effect on what's going on, and the more people you bring in, the greater need for judicial services, then the growth of, you know, the district attorneys and all of this kind of thing, it goes on. Interestingly enough, in the middle of this, like 1977, I decided I would go back into private practice. It's interesting because when I was appointed to the court, I was 35 years old. And as for an appellate judge, that's an extremely young age, and you have all these wonderful thoughts of vanity that you surely deserve this, and they picked you out. Of course, there's an experience factor in there, which later in my life, I wished I'd had the experience when I was on the court. But in any event, I went in, and of course, I had a large family by that time, and my family was growing up, and we never talked about the salary of a judge. Now, when he started out, the salary of a Supreme Court judge was $19,000 a year. I led a fight in the mid-60s to raise it to $28,000 a year. When I finally was appointed to the court in 1970, it was $42,000 a year. And I think in 1977, when I left, it was about $48,000. Now, I had five children. It was just not economically feasible for me to go much further because I think my oldest daughter was becoming a teenager by that time, or somewhere in that neighborhood. And you can't, it just is not economically feasible. And lawyers, of course, because of economic boom times, now we have North Slope, we have the pipeline going and so forth. There were all kinds of opportunities economically besides that. So I decided I'd go back in private practice.
Before we get to that, I want to ask you a couple of questions about your tenure on the bench. What did you find most satisfying about being on the bench?
Well, I enjoyed originally the intellectual stimulation, the fact we were dealing with problems which were basically somewhat unique of all during times, and you thought, well, gosh, I can be some part of this. I enjoyed that a great deal, and I enjoyed a number of the people on the court. That is what I enjoyed, but the thing I didn't enjoy is that you just, you had difficulty trying to find a variety of opinions outside of what, and the way that the judiciary is viewed in one sense is you're not supposed to talk to all kinds of people and be all sorts of things, but there's a point where your own experience runs out, and you're never sure about what all these factors, how you line them up, and how you give them importance. And so you have to rely on law clerks who have no practical experience, who have a great deal and good academic credentials, but you really don't make a lot of new friends, and that's one part of it that you don't think. And the other part of it is the speed of the slowest. And I happen to be
pretty fast.
Very fast. I read exceptionally fast. I work exceptionally fast. And it's like throwing an anchor out. I mean, I'm always waiting months to get a response to what I'm doing, and I find it hard to work that way. I mean, I don't, everybody knows that I'm a self-starter to the nth degree, let's put it that way, and I get my ideas together, I get the thing on paper, I work it over, and I send it out so we can, because I feel that the people can live with a result, no matter what the result is, they can't live with not knowing. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the problems we were having, was the speed at which we were acting. And that you know, even when I retired, that was the one thing that I couldn't change. Once, you know, we were still this business of, we had one judge in Fairbanks, one in Juneau, and three here. It's a hell of an administrative thing to accomplish, even if they work hard. And so I constantly agitated for getting us all in one place. I didn't really care where we were as long as we'd all in one place and we could do this fast. And, you know, that created some, because the judge in Juneau specifically didn't want to move out of Juneau. I could, Judge in Fairbanks, Rabinowitz, really went out of his way to accommodate that particular problem, but it's still, we still had this business of stuff that stick. And of course, the personalities of the people dictated how fast they worked anyway. So it was, it's awful hard to serve on a committee for 7 years, let's put it that way.
What do you think were the main strengths of the Alaska court system?
Well, in those years, intellectually, it was absolutely brilliant court, in my opinion. I think across the country is recognized one of the best in the country by quite a ways. And it was young. Even when Justice Steinman was forced to retire by health, he was the oldest member at 52. And I mean, you're talking about a court who theoretically is going to be together 25 or 30 years. And it didn't. You know, I was the youngest. I retired immediately. Boney died in an accident. Justice Steinman had a reoccurrence of malaria from the Second World War. He also had was a victim, quite honestly, of medical malpractice in discovering a very serious cyst he had on his gallbladder. It was 3 pounds when they finally removed it, but almost killed him. He, for a full year, he suffered from it, and he lost 75 pounds. He went all the way down to 145 pounds. He was 6'3", and he was skin and bones.
And fine gentleman.
Yeah, and they finally took him to Seattle and did exploratory surgery on him. They found this horrendous cyst, which would literally have killed him. I mean, he was dying of a thing, and of course, he's retired by this time. He wouldn't, all the members of the court urged him to stay on, not to retire. He said he couldn't draw his salary. He didn't feel right about it because he was ill. And then when he gradually recovered, then he came back as a pro tem judge for a great period of time, and he was still a young man by that time. But you know, and a man of great compassion, just an absolutely marvelous man who Alaska was thing. I'd always felt like I remember as a boy, his father, who I considered, though brilliant, a very austere man, not warm at all. And then John was just the opposite. I always felt John was far a superior human being to his father because he had all of the compassion that you would hope you would find in a human being. And besides being intellectually very, very bright and very, very understanding as the way things went.
Yeah, I went to the same law school, so he immediately liked me because we went to the same law school.
He was a man that could get up, put on his coat, go over to the playground in Juneau, and play with the kids on the playground. I mean, that's the kind of man he was. It just a very delightful man in every way. So I just the court itself really, I thought, was doing well. It had all the problems that anything made up of five human beings would have, because that's just the way it is. You're never going to get five people with the same beliefs. And look at things the same way, or have the same personal traits or habits. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, it other than the speed, which I was never satisfied with, and I tried to get some rules established where you have limited times to do things. I've never accomplished that, but we just simply didn't mesh together too well. Let's put it that way. And the politics was still that you couldn't consolidate the court in one place because of politics from southeastern Alaska to Anchorage and so forth. There's a distrust which works back and forth, and it will always be there as near as I can tell. It's not, but anyway, I had thought, gosh, I don't want to sit here working at the slowest pace of my life. And so,
but didn't you consider it fortunate, or did you? I'd like to know your opinion that this Constitution was formed in 1959. You could look at all the mistakes that other states made. You formed a unified system with a merit selection plan rather than having contested judicial elections. Or don't you think those were good ideas?
Yeah, the judicial article works very well, Art. The problem basically is with the executive article that it really does give too much power to the governor.
Yes.
Because what happens is, and I've seen this time and time again, you have a legal problem and you give it to the Attorney General. The governor, though, makes the decision. And what he says is, gosh, I didn't know that. I'm not an attorney. And so what happens is you get a decision which you shouldn't get. It's a practical matter of somebody saying, tweet, don't do that. And so we get a lot of what I call judicial things, maybe the executive branch saying, ah, hell with it, I'm going to do that anyway. And I mean, it may be a constitutional right, it may be something else, or, you know, it may be something simple of, I'm not going to appeal that case, or I'm not going to do this or that. And somebody ought to be saying to them who has something. I reluctantly come to the conclusion that an elective attorney general would be a hell of a lot better system. Now, somebody says, why do you say that? Because I said, that's the only way you can, you know, you can take the political aspect away from the governor. Now, if you look in our Constitution, it specifically says that the governor is supposed to be responsible to the law as it is, but he has a political hat. And of course, I think Al Katie John is a total view of the political and the legal side of it. There's an issue of state sovereignty, in which the governor legally can't give up, which he did by virtue of the fact he wouldn't appeal Katie John, follow the writ of certiorari, which had been granted to the United States Supreme Court. He made a political decision on a legal issue.
That's correct.
And theoretically, every person in Alaska had that legal right. So, and that's not the only place it happened, it's just the most recent because everybody is aware of that. So that's one of the problems. Now, the judiciary system works well, and the problem, there's always the force at work where a decision without taking the facts offends somebody. I mean, it may be political, it may be religious, it may be something else. If a system of elected judges, they just simply go in and they bulldoze that guy, good, bad, or indifferent, away. It has nothing to do, we don't agree with you, you're out. Not whether it's fair, it's logical, or anything like that. So our system does have that bulwark against having that happen. And you run against your record, yes or no. We've only had two or three judges defeated in 45 years, and then in the selection of judges, the way that the system is set up, no one person has a great deal to say on who that judge is. I mean, you can express your view, but you don't get into these fights over the religious end of it like we do in the Supreme Court of the United States, or did this guy, is this the most brilliant guy that we've ever seen, or is he too brilliant, you know? Or is, you know, is he not dumb enough, or is he too dumb? We don't get those. And recently, even Murkowski, when he rejected the name, somebody said to him, hey, from his own party, saying, hey, you don't have a right to select. The people, through these representatives, has a right to select. So we have been insulated from what I call the political pressure. And as a judge, I met with and went to a lot of judicial conferences where people really talked about how can I get my campaign committee and how can I get this support and that support and so forth, which you really shouldn't think a lot about when you're a judge. There are enough problems trying to line up or to evaluate all the factors which are fair without having to say, gosh, will that offend my constituency, or will it? That's for congressmen, or that's for somebody else. It's not for a judge. And I have one comment here. The cases which we found the most controversial between us personally were not cases which were big cases. They were little cases in which we simply disagreed as, for whatever reason, for background, for education, for philosophy, we just couldn't get. So we would get a 3-2 opinion on something that really didn't mean anything to anybody. And I have one case where, and it was a criminal case, it was a search and seizure case, and you have, almost all criminal cases have some search and seizure type thing into it. And so we had this case, and I think it was way back in the days when, before Boney died. And so we just couldn't agree. It was 3-2, and we were right on the thing. Then Boney dies, and it becomes 2-2. Then they appoint someone for Boney, and then Diamond, and it goes 3-2 the other way, and then Diamond retires, and it goes 3-2. But 3 or 4 years have gone by, and so the opinion finally comes out, and I thought, it's never going to be printed. It's almost like history. And then I get called. Somebody says, there's a call on the phone for you, and so I pick up the phone, and it's the defendant. He said, "You're ruining my life. You're this invasion of privacy. I've been in, sir, my time." And we had labored and brought forth this brick. So you had to remember, this is people you're talking about. Yes. You know, you can't, you can get carried away with the majesty of the law, but again, it's talking about people and right. how it affects people. And, you know, the one thing that a judge can't do, you have no idea when you write an opinion what that effect is going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And so if you're thinking you're omnipotent, that's a real problem.
We're going to take a 5 minute break here, Bob, because Taylor needs to move. She stands here still for an hour. I had to tell everybody this, that Taylor needs to get some blood flowing in her
life. Well, you have a problem. I've been around too long, so you get to.
You what?
I've been around too long.
Oh, right. So
this is my 46th year practicing law.
Is it great?
Is it?
Yeah. I've been a lawyer for a long time.
I
get a lot of places. I get to.
Okay.
Yeah, life is a...
Let me just do a lap around the hall?
Do a lap around the hall.
I'll be right back.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a funny part. You know, if you leave out the personalities, and of course you can. Personalities are, as you know, what can you say? It happens.
You got to deal with the personalities.
Well, they, 25 years as you look back, you know, at the time, God, you just put your teeth on edge. But whether or not they actually changed anything or had any real effect, the answer is probably no. You know, but it's they did delay some things happening, and you know, it personally they were hell on life. You know, Roger's life was about as chaotic as
anybody's
life would be. Yeah. Yeah. And how he even functioned under that, I have no idea. You know,
I know.
But I mean,
then you guys put me in a position one time saying I had to approve him running cars.
Yeah.
He's my boss. He walked in. This guy asked me if he could rent a car. And I said, Roger, you rent a car whatever you want. Don't come ask me.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Of course, he lost that car down
there. Yeah, that's why you guys told me I had to get my permission.
I know. And, you know, but his life, you know, he'd be down. We couldn't find him. He would be down at Alyeska, or he'd be somewhere else. Right. We have no idea where he is.
His wife is trying to drive a car through the picture window of the house.
Yes, you know. And all of the things that happened, you know, he just and he was a brilliant mind, but he intellectually lazy, so he just didn't do it.
Roger was strange, I have to admit. Roger was strange.
He had a great deal of ability, and he didn't exercise it. That's all he could say. George, on the other hand, was a total enigma, except if you understand Southern sheriffs, he fit in that category.
I only met George once, and that was when he and I think Jay came down to South Carolina to try to convince the Chief Justice's conference to come up to Alaska for a meeting. And I was at that meeting, and that's why I met he and Jay. They wouldn't remember me, but I remember them there trying to...
Well, yeah, he went to Harvard Law School, and he was a Southern cracker, and he turned out to be a liberal, which would really surprise everybody. And he was incredibly bright. I was personally convinced he wasn't going to stay on the court, that he was probably going to run for governor. That was my personal opinion from talking to him. And he had a chaotic private life, which, you know, given all the things that happened, those aspects of it were difficult. And of course, as you know, I didn't get along with Bob Bucci. He personally, I can never get along with somebody who is indirect as Bob was. He never said what he meant or anything the first time around. I mean, he circled around.
Well, that's what I learned about you. You were direct. I could always talk to you.
Yeah, I just couldn't. Bob, I just, you know, if I wanted to find out something about what Bob was thinking, I'd have my secretary call his secretary, who would call his law clerk. I mean, if I asked him a direct question, he gave me an answer, I knew that wasn't what he was, you know, I couldn't realize, and I didn't have time for that. I just, you know, Christ, I had five kids, and we were traveling and so forth, and the problem was Bob was appointed to the court on the grounds that he was a very bright lawyer, and he wasn't a bright lawyer. And I mean, I can tell you that. It's just, I mean, what always amazed me that Rabinowitz had great respect for him, and Rabinowitz was at least 10 times smarter than he was, and he spent half his time trying to make sure that Bob was going the right way. I get an opinion from Bob, and Christ, I'd read him a critique that would curl his hair. He had this pride of authorship, and the one thing that drove me nuts is any criticism, any little newspaper, anything like that, he'd spend all his time writing a response.
I know, he told me to hire a public relations person. Oh. I said, are you going to explain your opinions to this person?
No.
Well, what good kind of public relations person?
He was always over at Bill Tobin's office trying to write, get some kind of, I said, he was the most redneck guy I have ever met. I mean, any criticism at all, he was off on the,
maybe he should have gotten mad at me when I fired Marilyn Martin. And he said, why didn't you ask me before you did that? And I said, because when you hired me, part of the agreement was I hired and fired my own staff, and your only thing you can do is hire and fire me. And if you want to go fire me, go ahead. But I can't work with
him. And then of course the other promise was he would be here all the time. And of course he immediately reneged on that promise. And I don't, I of course, as you know me, I just didn't have time for that. I thought, as I was doing things, I thought, God, I would be happier back in private practice. And I was. I didn't look forward to working more years with Lou Cheever. If I'd have known he was going to the Ninth Circuit, maybe I'd have stayed around. But, I'm not sure that's true.
Well, I don't know. I think you were fun to work with because you had ideas and you expressed them. And I don't know. I was personally not that happy to do that, but it was none of my business. Yeah. But
well, I basically, I'm different. Somebody said to me, well, how come you go to that coffee store? I said, look, you got to find out what the hell's going on. If you know what's going on, then you have some chance of surviving. You can't just sit up there and pray. many times, I would say to Ed Burke, for Christ's sake, if we look over that little park and they're gathering a crowd and they have a flag, let's get the hell out of here. I said, well, this is people. we've got to understand what the hell we're doing. And we've got to understand what they're doing. Because if you think we can write an opinion that they can't find a way around, I said, we're talking with people, that's their bread and butter. And I said, Christ, if you think that we're putting nails in this, you're crazy. And I still feel that way. I'm here in court now, I pray when I say I passed 150, I'd appealed 50 cases. I've written 100 since then, And I appeared in court, almost every other month for years. And you just, you see the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing. The reason why, they're far too remote. There's nothing you can do about that.
No, there's not.
The idea of the court itself, and Jay and I disagreed on that. He felt there's the magistracy of the court. My whole view of that, I understand Jay's view of, the hierarchy thing. I don't believe in that, So we disagreed on that, whether or not the court itself, separate from the people, has something. And he said, yes, you had to reinsure it. You couldn't have your judges doing this and doing that and so forth. And I said, you pick these people because of their talents and their ability. I said, there are 99% of the cases don't come to court. We need them desperately in the community to give some guidance to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when you take them out, we take the best and the brightest, and then we hope the rest do fine. It shouldn't be that way. We hire law clerks because we think we're going to funnel them into the communities and they'll be really good. And I said, we exercised great responsibility, and we did a great thing with that. But I said, this business, we managed to break the barrier from women for law clerks. When they hired those first women, God, there was calamity from all over the country. It was really funny because I went to a couple of judicial conferences. And I literally had wives beating on me. I laughed until tears came to my eyes. I don't know what the hell he thought was going on, but I didn't, whatever it was. But in any event, to make those kind of changes and just for the community to see it, I think just in the first couple of years, we had a whole string of things in the court that was going bad. And Herb Shaman said, "Now, will you come out? We got to explain some of this stuff." And so he said, "All right, I'll be on the evening news three nights a week for 10 minutes.